So we heard on Monday night there was a long glorification about the glories of Krishna Katha. This was on verses. Yeah, no more than that. From verses, say, 7, 8, all the way up until verse 16. Discussing the glories of Krishna's. Hearing about Krishna, hearing and chanting about Krishna, the effect of hearing Srimad Bhagavatam.
You want to ask about the material aspect of happiness, because you must first understand about the that you cannot get happiness in the material world before you can get attached to spirit. So Srimad Bhagavatam very close, very categorically, so systematically covers first the material aspects and creation, that we understand about material nature before we go to.
Very good. So, even though Maitreya Muni, Vidura, would like to hear about Krishna's pastimes himself, because he is a Rasika Bhakta, which means he is on the platform of Prema Bhakti, and he is on the platform of relishing Krishna's pastimes. He has a taste for hearing about Krishna's pastimes directly. It means about the Lord's pastimes when he appears in this material world. Everyone gets settled, huh? So, he has a taste for hearing about Krishna's pastimes in the when he appears within this material world. Not just his secondary pastimes in relationship with his creation of the material world, but Krishna's direct pastimes, his primary pastimes. His pastimes with his pure devotees in Vrindavan, in Mathura, and within Dwarka. So Vidura has a taste for hearing about these things, but he understands that the conditioned souls will benefit greatly by hearing an analytical study or an analysis of the nature of the material energy. Because by understanding how the material energy is created, and by understanding what the material energy is constituted of, or what it is made up of, it will help to breed vairagya or detachment within the consciousness of the conditioned souls. So therefore, the Srimad Bhagavatam needs to be spoken categorically. Krishna's pastimes will not be elaborately described until the 10th canto of the Bhagavatam. Even though the 10th canto is the largest canto within the Bhagavatam, the 10th canto has 90 chapters or so within it. Whereas the other cantos, Canto 3 is a very large canto. The Canto 3 only has 33 chapters. So we can see that the Srimad Bhagavatam will mainly speak about Krishna's pastimes. Like that. But it will not go directly to Krishna's pastimes, because the conditioned souls need to give up their attachment, or the disease that they have, attachment to the material energy, needs to be cleansed, or needs to be cured, before they can fully appreciate Krishna's pastimes. So therefore, my Vidura is asking my trainer about the creation, understanding his desires.
You should be moving from sadhana bhakti to raga bhakti, the spontaneous love of Krishna. Not because it has to be done, but because Krishna wants it. That sort of bhakti you should be able to do.
Yeah, this was mentioned in one of the purports by Prabhupada.
First four.
Any other points?
I think in text 3 we talk about how our mission on behalf of the great acharyas, like Mahaprabhu, like Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and our spiritual masters, is to distribute the fruits of love of Godhead. So we have to distribute Krishna consciousness to others. And I think he gave the analogy of how we pick the fruits of the tree and give it to others. And, or Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in the Chaitanya
Charitamrita,
I think, was giving that analogy.
Yeah,
in the
Adi. Yeah. Okay. Last one. There are two parts of Krishna Katha listening to Srimad Bhagavatam in the Bhagavad Gita.
Krishna Katha will help us to develop detachment, especially family relationship.
Very powerful verses which are given especially verses 13, 14, 15, 16. These verses are very powerful about the therapeutic effect of Krishna Gita. How Krishna Gita purifies all attachments within the heart of the living entity so that he can fully surrender unto Krishna. Like that. Attachment to family life, which is the strongest attachment within this material world. Very difficult for the conditioned soul to give up attachment to one's family. Just like in my backyard and home, I've been hanging the washing out to dry. And the pigeons built my nest in the tree, just near the washing line. And I hang out all the washing the other day, and I came back in the afternoon, they passed stool all over. Like that. So I had to go and get the nest and, you know, remove the nest because I wanted them to go away because I haven't got time to wash my clothes, you know, continuously. And then they came back and the next day and started making the nest again. So then I what they made, you know, I tried to shoot them away and then I took away what they made and they came back the next day. And it's like we've got this whole lila going on now. Between me and the pigeons. It's been going on for like a week, you know. They just keep coming back every day and start making it. And then I just saw. One time Prabhupada was walking in a park and Prabhupada stopped under a tree and there was a pile of bird stool under the tree. And Prabhupada said, just see, even the pigeons are attached to their house. They're attached. They will not live just in any place. They become attached to their nest. And these pigeons come, even though I took away all the twigs and the branches, they come back to exactly the same spot and start to build their nest once again.
Maybe they are thinking that you are doing the same. You are not moving out of the house.
Yeah, I don't want to move them. Like I'm happy for them to stay there. But the point is that they, like, it's not practical for me. I like the pigeons, but it's not practical. So the point is that this is the nature of the material energy, right? The deepest attachment in the material energy is to sex life. And sex life is manifested on the gross platform, but on the subtle platform, to attachment to one's family. Yeah. And because of this attachment to family, this is the hardest attachment to give up in this material world. And the only way that one can purify, not that one has to give up family life, but the only way one can purify one's attachment to family life in this world is by hearing Krishna Katha. All of the other processes of Vedic processes, they may remove that attachment and that desire, but not eternally or not permanently. Even the jnanis, they lose their attachment to family life, their attachment to their material body, like that. But then, in due course of time, they may go to the Brahma Jyoti, but in due course of time, they will come back again to this material world and have to begin the whole process once again. So therefore, Krishna Gita is the only thing which will eternally cleanse these attachments away so that we can enter back into the spiritual world. Any other points?
I've just covered it.
So, any other points?
Key
memory verses, yeah. There are several key memory verses in this chapter. Important verses. Okay, so now we'll discuss tonight verses 17 to 26. Like that. And then on Monday night, we'll discuss verses 18 to 38. So tonight, within this chapter, chapter 5, and then continuing into chapter 6 and into chapter 7, the process of creation is about to be described within the Bhagavatam for the first time since the second canto. In the second canto, in verses chapters 4, especially chapter 5 and chapter 6 of the second canto, there was a brief description of the creation. And now, within the third canto, for the first time in the third canto, then we are seeing there will be a description of the creation given for these three chapters. Between chapters 5, it begins, and then into chapter 6 and chapter 7. This will be the first description of the creation, which will be given. In chapter 8, there will be another description of the creation given. But in each description of the creation, there is a different emphasis placed within the description. In other words, the description, some of the details are quite similar in each of the descriptions, but we see that the emphasis in each description is slightly different. So the first one, in chapter 5 to 7, the emphasis is very much on the Lord directly, on Lord Mahavishnu directly, and then Garbhodaksha Vishnu and so forth directly. The emphasis is on them and their kind of position within the creation. Whereas in the next explanations of creation and so forth, it may be more into analysing the elements and so forth, which are being used for the creation. So the creation will be spoken this time, and then it will be spoken again in chapter 8. And then later on in the Bhagavad Gita, around about chapter 25, there will be a third description by Kapiladeva. But each time there's some differences between the descriptions like this. Okay. So chapter 5. Verse number 17. Shukadeva Goswami said, "The great sage Maitreya Muni, after honoring Vidura very greatly, began to speak at Vidura's request for the greatest welfare of all people." So I read the purport. Shukadeva, can you read it?
The great sage Maitreya Muni is described here as Bhagavan because he surpassed all ordinary human beings in learning and experience. Thus, his selection of the greatest welfare service for the world is considered authoritative. The all-inclusive welfare service for the entire human society is a devotional service to the Lord. And as requested by Vidura, the sage describes the same very appropriately.
So what is the point here?
Welfare of the society is in devotion service of the Lord.
What was that?
Welfare of the society is in devotion service to the Lord.
You should hear from the authorities.
What should you hear from the any other point?
If you are learned and experienced, then you can be called Bhagavan. But you have got to be very high in experience and then surpassing all the common people.
But you can't call yourself Bhagavan.
No, that's what I'm saying. You have to surpass.
Yeah. Other people may call you Bhagavan. And you can't call yourself Bhagavan. Okay. It's like Srila Prabhupada. Prabhupada had the title Prabhupada, and then Prabhupada's godbrothers criticized him. They said, "Why are you using this title?" Prabhupada said, "I'm not using the title." Prabhupada never called himself Prabhupada. Right? He called himself Swami. But that was his title. But then his disciples called him Prabhupada. That was okay. That was appropriate. So, any other points?
The devotion service is called comprehensive.
So he is being called Bhagavan by Vidura. This is the position of Maitreya Muni. That you'll see within the Srimad Bhagavatam, Shiva is called Bhagavan, Narada is called Bhagavan, Maitreya here is being called Bhagavan. So they are such qualified personalities, they are receiving this title. Okay. So it is not that they have become the Supreme Personality of Godhead. It doesn't mean that they are on the level of Krishna in terms of their opulence and power. But they are so pure and have been so empowered by Krishna as Shaktyavesh avatars that they may be called Bhagavan. But not that they have become equal to Krishna in every respect. Okay. Now, what is his qualification for being called Bhagavan? Because he has completely assimilated and absorbed the science of devotional service. So because he fully realizes the signs of devotional service, he is fully competent to teach that to others. And therefore, he has been given so much honor. Srila Prabhupada pointed out that the spiritual master must be as honored as much as the Supreme Personality of Godhead himself. Just like when Prabhupada came to the airport here in Melbourne, and the devotees picked Prabhupada up in a Rolls Royce, and then the reporter said, "Swamiji, why your movement is speaking about renunciation, your disciples are living very austerely, and you're being picked up in a Rolls Royce." Prabhupada said, "I say that is not enough. I say there should be a golden chariot." Because, not that Prabhupada was thinking that he is Krishna, but he is thinking that the representative of Krishna must be honored as much as Krishna himself. So that is the respect. So here, Vidura is calling Maitreya Bhagavan, right, giving the same respect as Krishna himself, because he is giving Krishna to the conditioned soul. He is teaching them the signs of Krishna, and therefore he will receive that honor. Not that the spiritual master thinks he is God, but he accepts. Prabhupada said, the spiritual master is collecting obeisances on behalf of Krishna. Just like the king has a tax collector. Right? So the king has the tax collector who will go out and collect all the money for their kingdom. So the spiritual master, Prabhupada said, he is obeisances collector. So he will go out and he will collect the obeisances. Not that he accepts that the obeisances are being offered to him, but he understands this is being offered to Krishna. So therefore Prabhupada says the guru is the transparent via medium, which means that it comes through the guru, but the guru never accepts it for himself or keeps it for himself. He passes all of that honor onto Krishna. That is his qualification for the guru.
It's just analogy why it's called Bhagavan, it's like a son of a rich man. It's also called warrior in spoil, so he doesn't have his money, his father has it. But he's also called, they might call him rich.
What is the meaning of Prabhupada?
Prabhupada means at whose feet all the masters sit.
And it's also said that the Guru's body is the embodiment of all demigods. Sarva Deva Maya Guru. Acharya.
Same as the goal, the cow. Any other points here? Okay. Sri Maitreya said, "O Vidura, all glory unto you. You have inquired for me of the greatest of you have inquired for me of the greatest of all goodness, and thus you have shown your mercy both to the world and to me, because your mind is always absorbed in thoughts of transcendence."
Maitreya Muni, who was experienced in the science of transcendence, could understand that Vidura's mind was fully absorbed in transcendence. Adoksaya means that which transcends the limit of sense perception or sensuous experience. The Lord is transcendental to our sense experience, but he reveals himself to the sincere devotee. Because Vidura was always absorbed in thought of the Lord, Maitreya could estimate Vidura's transcendental value. He appreciated the valuable inquiries of Vidura and thus thanked him with great honor.
So what are the points here?
Because Vidura was always thinking about the Lord Krishna. So Matthew he was also very much elevated. He was also absorbed in transcendence, so he could understand that Vidura is fully absorbed in the thought of the Lord, and so he appreciated it very much.
The speaker and the hearer are both pleased to talk about and hear about Krishna. Both are very enthusiastic.
We are getting the opportunity to speak. He's giving Indra is giving the opportunity to Maitreya Muni to glorify the Lord, and also these things are beneficial for their common people. So showing does it both like to you?
So the devotees always appreciate the association of other devotees. They're always eager to receive the association of other devotees. Why?
To remember Krishna and think about Krishna and get reminded about Krishna.
Yeah, so we can hear and chant about Krishna. Because without the association of the devotees, we cannot have Shravanam and Kirtanam. We cannot hear and chant about Krishna without the association of all the Vaishnavas. So therefore the devotees are always very eager to have the association of the Vaishnavas. Mm-hmm. They're always eager to find other Vaishnavas. So we see here that Vidura is being appreciated by Maitreya, because Vidura is an eternal associate of Krishna. Right? He is a very intimate associate of Lord Krishna. And because he is a very intimate associate of Krishna, and Maitreya Muni personally received Krishna's association at the end of his pastimes in this material world. So both of them are on the transcendental platform, on the platform of prema. So therefore, they automatically feel very satisfied in each other's company. And devotees will feel like that, that when they come in contact with another devotee and they perceive that that devotee has deep realization about Krishna, automatically they will want to begin to discuss about Krishna to get that devotee's realization. So he's feeling very appreciative of the opportunity to associate with Vidura. Okay.
The common interest. They have a common interest.
Yeah, same. Oh, Vidura. It is not at all wonderful that you have so accepted the Lord without deviation of thought, for you were born from the semen of Vyasadeva.
The value of great parentage and noble birth is evaluated here in connection with the birth of Vidura. The culture of a human being begins with the father invests his semen in the womb of the mother. According to his status of work, a living entity is placed in a particular father's semen, and because Vidura was not an ordinary living entity, he was given the chance to be born in the semen of Vyasa. The birth of a human being is a great science, and therefore reformation of the act of the implementation according to the Vedic ritual called Garbhadana Samskara is very important for generating good population. The problem is not to check the growth of the population, but to generate good population on the level of Vidura, Vyasa and Maitreya. There is no need to check the growth of population when the children are born as human beings with all the precautions regarding the birth. So-called birth control is not only vicious but also useless.
A lot of points.
They say that there is no need for birth control as it is practiced nowadays. But the thing is, there should be a good population, a very high class parentage. Those who are lover of Lord.
Purification starts from birth.
Yeah.
The samskaras, the various samskaras.
Before birth.
Before birth. Starts from there.
Yeah.
Yeah, sometimes they say, oh, the grandfather's qualities come in children, right? No? Then they call that the qualities of the parents, the consciousness, goes to the children. And when they name the children, that tells much about the parentage themselves. Because what was their mind to name the child like this? So they sometimes call them children. So with great hope, the children they name them.
Prabhupada mentions how devotees or devotees of the Lord, they have systematic in everything, every part, in every step of their life, like, you know, having marriage is systematic and having a childhood is systematic. It's not like an ordinary man, they just do for the self-gratification.
So we see that Prabhupada mentions some very important preaching points within the purport. He says that there is no problem with overpopulation. Prabhupada has covered this point in the last few chapters. Sometimes they say that, or they're saying that there will be something like 9 billion, at the moment there's about 6 billion human beings on earth. They're saying there will be 9 billion by, I think, 2020 or something like that, or 225, I can't remember exactly. But they're saying that things will increase very rapidly, and they are concerned how the earth will hold so many human beings. But Prabhupada is not concerned, because Prabhupada is pointing out that the Lord will supply, but the earth has to be managed in a very natural way. At the moment, there's a very unnatural system of government and civilization, that we have people living in huge cities, 20 million people in one city. Right? It's not natural. Right? In Vedic times, you would not have 20 million people in one city. I mean, of course you would, you'd have to walk her and so forth like that, but these kind of cities, even those cities that was described, there were parks. Right? If you have the description of Dwarka in Canto 1, the roads were very wide. Right, there were parks there were birds there were Brahmanas chanting Vedic mantras, everything was very natural still. But with the modern system of government and so-called civilization, then we're not seeing a natural state of living in the world. And therefore, there is a great amount of problem with overpopulation. And in China, for example, they're saying that something like, I can't remember the exact figure, but something like 50,000 people a month are moving into the cities. And they can't possibly keep up with the growth of the amount of people coming. And the cities are getting, I mean, in China you already have, you know, 11 million people in the city, 16 million people in the city, these kind of numbers. And the amount of people coming in, it's just going to cause chaos. It's a very unnatural state. So Prabhupada is saying there's no problem with overpopulation on the earth, but simply people have to live in a very natural way, not the way they're living now. If you have too many people on earth the way they're living now, there will be problems. Okay. So Prabhupada says the problem is not that we are worried about overpopulation. Now Prabhupada points out the second preaching point that he brings up is about conception. The conception in Vedic times was done very responsibly. When the mother and father conceived a child, it was with great responsibility. And they understood that the result of engaging in sex life is that one will create a child. Prabhupada points out in the purport, preaching to the materialistic state of consciousness very heavily, that contraception, which they are using now in the modern society, is both vicious and useless. Right? Because it is vicious because one is killing. If a man passes semen and it is not for the purpose of procreating or creating a child, it is considered to be sinful. And it creates disharmony or a chaotic effect within the laws of the universe. Whenever a male species of life, not just humans, but any species of life, when the male passes semen, the only reason for that activity is to create a child. And you'll see in the animal species, that is the only reason they perform this activity, is to create a child, like that. Whereas in the human's form of life, with their more developed intelligence, they're using contraception to try to manipulate the material energy. And in this way, it is creating great disturbances within the material nature. Because when everyone follows the laws of the material nature properly, when the matter passing is semen for the proper reason, then everything is harmonious within the universe. But when there is irregular sex life, illicit sex life, then everything within the universe becomes unharmonious. Because souls which are meant to be entering wombs are being restricted from entering it. So all the karmic activity becomes very complicated. And the consciousness of the jivas becomes very disturbed by this activity. So Prabhupada says it's very vicious, because it's actually killing, just like abortion and so forth, it is killing the child, it is murder. Just like you see in the modern world, in the Western world, even maybe in India and so forth these days, in the Western world, they have these debates over abortion. Whether it is actually murdering the child, and then they have all these debates and they say, well, after 6 months it is murder. But before 6 months it is not murder. Like that. No, it is murder, right, from the very beginning. Right? It is even murder. It is even considered to be sinful to engage in sex life. And even if there is no conception which takes place and no abortion, but if there is contraception used, that is considered to be sinful. So Prabhupada is very direct and very heavy on these points. And this is very important in our preaching, to understand these messages like that. That it is sinful. These kind of activities are sinful, and they do create karmic reactions within the universe. And you cannot have a peaceful society and civilization unless the individuals within that society and that civilization are acting according to Dharma or religion. So Prabhupada said it is useless to try to stop the children being born. What needs to be done is the children need to be conceived in a proper state of consciousness, and that will create a good population. Just like in Lord Ramachandra's appearance day, we were hearing about how Maharaj Dasharatha, Ram's father, did not have any children. So he wanted to have children, and the great sages, they advised him that if you want to have a child, perform an Ashwamedha Yajna. And that would purify your consciousness sufficiently so that you would then be able to conceive a child. So within the within ISKCON, within our society, when the Grihasthas want to conceive a child, Prabhupada has instructed they must chant 50 rounds of the Maha Mantra before they engage in the act of conception. And in this way, it is like performing a yajna. It is a yajna. Sankirtan yajna. Nam yajna, japa yajna. And in this way, they purify the consciousness so that they will attract a pious soul into the womb of the mother, which will then create good population. So Prabhupada is saying that it is useless to try to control the population by contraception and so forth. The real way to control and to create good progeny on earth and a peaceful society on earth is that there must be good state of consciousness at the time of conception. This is the actual secret to having a positive population on earth. And we see here that Vidura is the son of Vyasadeva. Yeah. Son of Vyasadeva. And even Vyas himself, his father was Parashara. And we see within the Mahabharata that Parashara was crossing the river in a boat, crossing across the Ganges, and the boat was being rowed by Satyavati. Right? Satyavati was a princess. Right there. So,
Satyavati was the daughter of a fisherman.
Yes. Yeah, but she was actually the daughter of the royal dynasty, if you read the Mahabharata.
Okay.
If you read the Mahabharata, I won't tell the whole story because these stories in the Mahabharata are very lengthy. But there's a whole story. She's actually, if you read the Mahabharata, it's described. She's actually the daughter of a kshatriya, a prince and princess.
Okay.
Like that. But She was found within the belly of a fish. It's the Mahabharata, and the stories are very elaborate, so we can't tell why, but actually. So, now Parashara, he was crossing the river with Satyavati, who was rowing the boat, and he saw it was an astrologically auspicious time for a great soul to enter into this world. So therefore he said to Satyavati, we must conceive a child now. And Satyavati, she could see that Parashara's countenance or his consciousness was pure. He did not want to engage in, unite with her out of lust. But rather he wanted to attract a auspicious soul into the world at that time. He wanted to give birth to Vyasadeva at that time. So in this way, Vyasadeva was conceived at this point in time. And then Vyas conceived Vidura, like that. So we see that when the consciousness of the parents is correct, right, when the consciousness of the parents is purified by jagya or sacrifice, then they will automatically conceive God-conscious children. But if they're simply engaging in sex life for sense gratification, then the children will also have that same state of consciousness.
Yes, I mean, the same for Vyasadeva and the Pandu, the parents, if the mother also has to have proper consciousness, not only the father, because the Dhritarashtra and Pandu, when Pandu was alright spiritually, but physically he was right. So the mother has to be with the right consciousness too.
Any other questions?
And also in Gita, Krishna says that sex life for procreating is not a dharma, like that. Dharma will be a Muslim.
I am that.
And sex life.
Yeah, which is according to religious principles. Yes. Yeah, very good.
About the overpopulation. In Bhagavad Gita, in the third chapter, it's written that the Lord created the demigods and the human beings and the yajna, and he said that the human beings can perform yajna and the demigods will supply them all the requirements for living. So we don't have to worry about overpopulation, as Sri Prabhupada is saying.
Yeah, that's true. Good point. Arvidura, it is not at all wonderful that you have so accepted the Lord without deviation or fraud. Do you read that? I know that you are now Vidura due to the cursing of Mandavya Muni, and that formerly you were King Yamaraj, the great controller of living entities after their death. You were begotten by the son of Satyavati, Vyasadeva, in the kept wife of his brother. So he is a great soul. Vidura is Yamaraj himself. Yamaraj was cursed by Mandavya Muni, like that, and then he took birth as a Shudra. Like that. So Vidura was considered to be Shudra because Vyasadeva conceived Vidura in a maidservant. She was not the princess, she was a maidservant. So therefore she was considered to be Shudra by caste. So by caste, Vidura was considered to be Shudra by caste. But by consciousness, he was Paramahamsa. Right? He was Yamaraj himself, most exalted personality. And those who understood who he was gave him great respect. He was very respected. Even though we saw in the first chapter, even though he was considered to be not a royal member of the dynasty, but still he was always consulted by all the Kshatriyas, right, for his wisdom, because he's Yamaraj himself. He's practically the wisest person in the universe, practically, besides Lord Brahma and so forth.
I thought he was the the maid servant of Dhritarashtra's mother.
His mother.
Vidurji's mother.
Yeah.
Was the
maidservant.
maid servant of this disaster's mother.
True.
But he said kept wife.
Yeah, similarly.
I think usually the maids which they come with the princesses, with the queens, they are actually sometimes they enjoy with the king, like Sharmishta and Devyayani.
Yeah.
Sharmishta came with Devyayani as maid servant, and then she conceived the child with Guru with Yadu.
Yeah.
So I think there's
that's the system. The Kshatriyas are very passionate by nature. And because the Kshatriyas are very passionate by nature and they have strong sex desire, then they're allowed to have sexual pleasure with the maid servants of the queen also.
Mm.
Like that. So sometimes the children are born from the maid servants of the queen and they're kept within the palace as members of the palace, but they're never allowed to become royalty, or they're never allowed to accept the throne, or they're never allowed to marry Kshatriyas and princesses and princes like that. But they're kept within the palace because they're members of the family, but they're like unroyal members of the family like that. They never get the exact privileges of the royal family mm-hmm. itself.
Mm-hmm. So is it the bride after the Vedic regulations?
Is that okay?
Is that the right thing as per the Vedic regulations?
Yeah. Because there is the four regulative principles: no meat eating, no illicit sex, no intoxication, and no gambling. But the Kshatriyas are allowed to have some limited engagement in all of those activities. Sometimes they eat meat. Right, they're allowed to. Like Prabhupada said, Bhinu ate meat. Okay. They're allowed to. Sometimes they'll have extra sex life, like that, outside of their marriage. They're not married to the maidservant, like that. It's not forbidden for them. They're allowed to take some intoxication, just like you saw the Yadu dynasty. They took some intoxication, the rice wine, like that. And gambling, like Yudhishthira was doing the gambling, like that. So the Kshatriya is allowed to have some, not unlimited, like unrestricted, but they're allowed to have some of that, those activities in the Kshatriya, but the other Vaisyas are not allowed to. Brahmins, Vaishyas and Sudras are not allowed to touch it. Okay.
See, in the purport of this one, it's written that Vyasdeva is the son of Satyavati, but the great king Santanu.
Vyasadeva is the son of Satyavati.
By the great king Santanu.
Shantanu.
By the great king Shantanu. The father of Bhishma.
Yeah, I thought it was Parashar.
Vyasadeva is the son of Satyavati by the great king Shantanu.
It was written, Prabhu, I can comment on that, I don't know whether it's applicable here.
Mm-hmm.
When Kunti was mentioned for Karna, in one place Prabhupada commented that the previous child of the wife, for example, Pandu should have considered Karna as his own son. So the son of the wife is considered as the son of the illegitimate husband.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that could be something like that. That kind of explanation. Okay. Vyasadeva is the son of Satyavati by the great king Shantanu. Okay? Your good self is one of the eternal associates of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, for whose sake the Lord, while going back to his abode, left instructions with me. So when the Lord leaves this world, then he leaves behind him Divya Gyan, or transcendental instructions. This is one of the Krishna's main purposes for entering into this world, is to leave transcendental knowledge. And therefore when Krishna entered this world, in his pastimes he spoke the Bhagavad Gita, he spoke the Uddhava Gita, he spoke this knowledge which is about to be discussed by Maitreya Muni, So this is one of his main reasons for entering this world, is to give transcendental knowledge for the benefit of the conditioned souls. I shall therefore describe to you the pastimes by which the personality of Godhead extends his transcendental potency for the creation, maintenance, and dissolution of the cosmic world as they occur one after another. So, Vidura has asked Maitreya Muni to describe about the creation, and now Maitreya is agreeing that he will describe the creation to Vidura. So this is the creation, the maintenance, and the destruction of the material energy. And these things will be described now in very great detail by Maitreya, like that. All of this goes on simply by the Lord's glance. You can say will or glance. So powerful is the Lord that simply by glancing or desiring, then the material world becomes created, it is maintained, and everything is destroyed. It is inconceivable how powerful the Lord is. And Krishna, who is at this very point in time, or even beyond time, at this very moment, where is Krishna? He's in Goloka Vrindavan. Right? At this very moment, Krishna is in Goloka Vrindavan, performing pastimes with his eternal associates. And his expansion of his expansion of his expansion is manifesting this material world at this point in time. Right? And Krishna is not even conscious of that it's all happening. Krishna in his original form is not even conscious that it is all taking place. He is so absorbed in enjoying pastimes with his associates. It is described by the Acharyas that Krishna is simultaneously Sarvagya and Muktata. Sarvagya means he is all-knowing. He knows everything. Right? But simultaneously he is Muktata, which means he forgets it all. So in Goloka Vrindavan, Krishna is just absorbed.
Muktata.
Muk means M-U-K.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and Datta, D-A-T-T-A, Muktata. Okay. So he is Sarvagya and Muktata, which means simultaneously he is remembering everything and simultaneously he forgets everything by the arrangement of Yoga Maya. So then he doesn't have any consciousness or any, is there another word?
Awareness. Awareness?
Yeah, any awareness that he is creating the material world.
He's not consciously thinking about that.
Yeah, no consciousness. Not consciously thinking that it is taking place. Just absorbed in his lila, in his pastimes. But simultaneously, his own self, who is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, his expansions, are creating and maintaining and destroying the universe perpetually. Yeah, and he's no consciousness that is taking place. Simultaneously, he knows everything. That is his supreme position.
Prabhuji, you have got Giriraji here. So I think Lord Krishna is here too. He's not only in Goloka Vrindavan, he's here.
He's here.
Yeah.
But you're the only one who can see him.
Just happened.
Yeah, this happens by the agency of Super Soul, Paramatma. Paramatma, that's how Krishna is Sabhya. Krishna is Sabhya through the agency of Paramatma. Right? Because Paramatma is everywhere, so therefore Krishna knows everything is Sabhya. Because Krishna is the source of Paramatma. Yet, he forgets everything like that. So, like that. Now, this is where the description of the creation begins at this point in time. Tonight we'll go to verse 26, and verse 25 and 26 is just the beginning of the description of the creation. But then on Monday night it'll begin to become more intricate. It'll go into more detail, like from now on. The personality of Godhead, the master of all living entities, existed prior to the creation as one without a second. It is by his will only that creation is made possible, and again everything merges in him. The Supreme Self is symbolized by different names. So does anyone recognize this verse from anything that we've read previously? Chaturshloki, yeah? Which verse of the Chaturshloki? The first verse of the Chaturshloki. So this verse is very similar to that first verse of the Chaturshloki. That before the creation, it is I only who existed. During the creation, it is I only. When everything else is destroyed, it is I only who remain. So this is where Maitreya Muni is beginning the description of the creation. And this knowledge, which was given to Lord Brahma in the very beginning of the creation of the material world, this knowledge of the Chaturshloki Bhagavatam, then this same knowledge is what Maitreya and Uddhava heard from Krishna just before he left this world. They heard Bhagavatam. They heard what we call the third and fourth cantos of the Bhagavatam. And it is all based on these four seed shlokas from the second canto of the Bhagavatam. So therefore, Maitreya is beginning his description of creation from the same place that Krishna began when he instructed Lord Brahma. The way he instructed Lord Brahma, the very first sambandhigya, the original knowledge, the Krishna sambandha. Then this is the same knowledge which Maitreya is beginning with, as he heard from Lord Krishna, as Lord Krishna described just before he left this world. So in that original verse of the Chaturshloki, Krishna uses the word aham three times. Right? That I am the... it was I who existed before the creation, it is I who exists during the maintenance, and it is I who exists when everything is destroyed. So remember when we studied that last year, that Lord Krishna was emphasizing his personality. Because Krishna wants everyone to understand that he is a person. There's nothing impersonal about the Srimad Bhagavatam. And to give an impersonal interpretation, as Prabhupada has pointed out in the previous last few chapters, Prabhupada gives that purport about Shankaracharya. And Prabhupada describes there that the Mayavadis, they like to give an interpretation upon the Chaturshloki of the Bhagavatam, and they give an impersonalistic interpretation. For Prabhupada points out to us, it is impossible to have an impersonalistic interpretation when someone says I three times within one shloka. How can that be construed to be impersonal? So therefore, it is simply, Prabhupada points out, it is simply their speculation. If they're saying that God is not a person, it's just speculation. And it means they're not actually learning about God in disciplic succession. Because if one is connected to a bona fide disciplic succession, one will understand that God is a personality. But because they are speculating without proper authority, connection to proper authority, they come up with an impersonalistic understanding, which is actually false. which has no authority, and which is based on word jaggery, simply. So Krishna is emphasizing here that I am the personality of Godhead. And this is the same place that Maitreya is beginning to describe the Lord's creation. And it is the Lord himself in his personal form who creates.
Well, one has to be above the moral goodness to say that he's a person.
To say that he's a person?
Yeah. But one has to be above the moral goodness. Means in pure goodness. If you are in just goodness, then you would think that the Lord is there, but he is impersonal.
Possible. Maybe.
And if you are in moral goodness, passion or ignorance, then you would say there is no God.
That's true.
Yeah?
Yeah. You can say about that.
I think that's what Srila Prabhupada said.
Prabhupada is saying about that.
What? I didn't understand
what you're saying.
Where Prabhupada said? I didn't run off the perfects.
In particular?
I remember reading it. It's not a purpose to say that more of goodness, you come to only the impersonal area of
form. One is in pure goodness, yeah. Or it means one has to be in pure goodness, or it means that one has to be... Yeah, either, Jerkin. Do you need some help?
Sorry, I have a spasm.
She
got a
cat.
It's in number 11,
Jolita.
In number 11.
Just
wait
a
second.
Does entropy mean any helpful?
No.
Okay.
Please, come. Right.
She's okay with it.
Sorry.
It's okay. What were you saying? Yeah, I know. What you, so it means that one has to be in the mode of pure goodness. So it means that one has to hear from someone who's in pure goodness. Because if one hears from someone who is in pure goodness, then one can understand Krishna as a personality. But if one on his own attempt tries to understand Krishna, if he's in the mode of goodness, then he'll come up with an impersonal understanding of that.
Can I ask you a question
about
the Bhagavad? Are we discussing here the material creation or the spiritual as well? Creation that we are talking here,
yeah.
Is it material creation or the spiritual, or creation as a just general word? Spiritual creation, the spiritual world creation. Sir?
The spiritual world doesn't become created.
So it's always there. Sir?
Yeah.
But then how, just then he says that it only me who was there when...
Yeah, so then you have to read the purport. Did you read the purport?
Yeah.
This is the problem. Everyone comes to class and they don't read the purports. But if you read the purport, Prabhupada explains this. Okay. So Prabhupada explains that just like when we refer to the king, then the king also means his entourage. So that we say, oh, the king has come. Just like, say, if Queen Elizabeth, the Queen of England, if she comes here to Melbourne, we say, oh, the queen has come. It's not just the queen, obviously. There's a whole entourage that surrounds her. So Prabhupada points out that when we say Krishna has come or Krishna existed, if you go back to the Chatur Shloki, then Prabhupada points out that that means the entire spiritual world. The spiritual world is never created. The spiritual world is eternal. Krishna is Sat Chit Ananda Vigraha. Right? And the spiritual world is also Sat Chit Ananda Vigraha. But that everything in the spiritual world is eternal. And without beginning, without end. Like that. So there's no creation of the spiritual world. Okay. Otherwise, if the spiritual world is created, that means that before it was created, it wasn't there. Then what was Krishna doing? He had to be something, he had to be doing something. So therefore, the spiritual world is eternal, just as he is eternal. Okay.
Everybody find really good sentences
Yeah.
Although the spiritual existence was there with the Lord, the material existence was dormant in him. By his will only is the material manifestation done and undone. The diversity of the Vaikuntha Loka is one with the Lord, just as the diversity of soldiers is one with and the same as the king.
Same point. So we need to read the next. This is what it says. Lord, the undisputed proprietor of everything, was the only seer. Because his manifestation was not present at that time, and thus he felt imperfect without his plenary and separated parts and parcels. The material energy was dormant, whereas the internal potency was manifested. Mm-hmm. So, the Lord, out of his compassion, he desires that the material energy becomes manifested. So at this point in time, the material energy is not manifest. Right? It is unmanifest. What is the material energy called when it is not in a manifested state, when it is unmanifested? Okay. We call it pradana. Okay. So these terms will become very well used in the next few chapters when we're beginning to describe the creation of the material world. So the material energy, when it is unmanifest, it is called pradana. Pradana means all of the material energy. So the material energy is made of the three modes of material nature: goodness, passion and ignorance. But it is not manifest at this point in time. Everything is merged. It's like there was like a lump of clay. So from the lump of clay, the potter will take the lump of clay and he'll put it on the potter's wheel, and he'll make a pot, and he'll make a jug, and he'll make a vase, and he'll make a cup, and he'll make a plate, he'll make a bowl. Right? So he uses the energy. But in the beginning, the clay is undefined. It is without shape, without form, without characteristic. So all of the material ingredients are simply merged together. Right? It's just like an energy. This is called pradana. This is the material energy before it is made. So the three modes of nature are there, but they are not differentiated. They're just all merged in together. And they're not active. There's no activity in the pradana. It's just like a lump of clay. It's like inert. Like that. The 24 material elements, like earth, water, fire, air, ether, mind, intelligence, ego, the five working senses, the five knowledge acquiring senses, the five sense objects, all those things, the 24 elements are all merged, right, in together in the pradana, but nothing is manifest at this point in time. Does this make sense to everyone? Make sense? Does it make sense to anyone? So this is called pradana. So the Lord, Mahavishnu, he glances at this pradana, and out of compassion, he wants the conditioned souls to go back to Godhead and to fulfill their material desires. Right? So that they will become exhausted of their material desires and desire to go back to Godhead. So for these two purposes, he glances at the pradana and begins to set the whole mahatattva in, or the material energy, into motion. So it is called pradana when there is nothing manifest. And then what do we call the material energy once it is glanced at by the Lord and it begins to begins to display characteristics. Yeah. Right, we call it? What do we call it? Prakriti. Huh? Make up your mind. What do we call it? What is it called? It is called Mahatattva. Mahatattva.
That's after the Lord glances.
What?
After the Lord glances.
Yeah, it is called Mahatattva when the Lord glances.
The glance is a time factor.
See, Roger, you're going back to that. Do you have an apple for dinner, Roger, or something?
That was
it's
And also this glance is Shiva.
Yeah, this will be described in the next chapter. So it means that when the Lord glances at the material energy, and when his glance contacts the material energy, the pradhan, and his glance begins to stir up the pradhan. In other words, it begins to make things manifest. Right? It begins to manifest the different elements. The three modes of material nature become separate and begin to manifest and show characteristics. At this time we call the material energy the Mahatattva. At this point. Right? But before that it is called pradhan.
So material
glance is the time and the jivas are there at the time.
Yeah,
the time limit is there. And that is how the actions take place.
There's a lot of things in there. You'll see when we discuss it. There's Ishta Shakti, there's Kriya Shakti, there's Jnana. There's many elements of that glance. All those things will be described.
So the material nature and material energy, it's the same thing.
Same thing, just a different word. Same thing. So here we are seeing the Lord's glance. So there are two reasons why the Lord glances, right? Out of his compassion, right? The two reasons are, he desires for the jivas to fulfill their material desires. Because he sees that the jivas have a desire to enjoy separate from him. So he wants to fulfill that desire. Man proposes, God disposes. They want to enjoy separate from him. So he facilitates that. So he glances at material energy. And in that glance, the jivas are impregnated into the material energy. And then the second reason why the Lord glances is because he wants the jivas to become frustrated in that material energy from trying to enjoy separate from him. He designs it in such a way, as he says in the Bhagavad Gita, Dukkhaya Ashapta. It is temporary and it is miserable. Huh? Just like the weather in Melbourne. It is miserable. Huh? This is the Lord's great mercy. Otherwise you'd be living in Brazil, you'd be very happy. So he glances, right, in order to for the jivas to fulfill their desires or become frustrated, so that they will begin to desire to go back to Godhead. So these are his two purposes right there. So with that end in mind, the Lord, he begins to stir up the material energy. We'll go into great detail about this in the next few weeks and months. Okay. The Lord is the seer, and the external energy which is seen works as both cause and effect in the cosmic manifestation. A greatly fortunate Vidura, this external energy is known as Maya or illusion, and through her agency only is the entire material manifestation made possible. So it is described that the material energy is both the
cause and the effect.
The cause and the effect. Yeah. The cause and the effect. Or in other words, the cause means the material energy is the substance. It is because of, or it is with the material energy that the Lord creates. Just like the example is given of the potter and the clay. So the clay is the substance which the potter uses. It is the cause. Right? Without clay, the potter cannot manifest. Right? He cannot create. So therefore, the pradhan, or the clay, or the material energy, is the Lord's energy. It is his inferior energy. It is his creation. And he uses that in order to create the material world. Right? To manifest all the different forms in the material world. So this is coming from the Lord's, and so does the cause, and it is the effect. Which means it is the energy. It means that once the Lord creates these different forms in the material world, then the whole thing becomes set in motion. And then it recreates itself again and again and again. But without the original creator, there is no possibility of anything being done. And it takes the Lord to create, to get things started. Just like Prabhupada would challenge the modern scientists
He would say, create one mosquito. He said, just create. He said, that's all you have to create. We don't want anything very elaborate, anything very complicated. He said, just create one mosquito, that's all. Right? Just create that. Right? It's not possible. Right? It's not possible for them to create, because the only person who can create is Krishna. Because he is the cause of all causes. He is the source of this spiritual energy. Therefore, Prabhupada says, life comes from life. Right? If there is no soul, right, to run that, to power that mosquito body, right, if the living entity, the jiva, does not enter into the body of the mosquito, then you may have the form of the mosquito, which the scientists, maybe they can create a form, but they'll never get it to fly. Right? Because the jiva has to enter. Right? And the only person who can create the jiva is God, right? Is the Supreme Lord Himself. So it is only the Ishwara, the Param Ishwara, that everything can. So it is the cause and the effect. The material world may seem to be affected. It may seem that, you know, generations are being created. You know, we have our children, they have their children, they have their children. Right? But we didn't actually begin anything. Right? It's the Lord who began everything. He used the material energy as a cause, and then he created the effects. And simply what we are doing, we are just part of the effect. You know, we just keep the whole thing going like that. We just keep, you know, society moving like that. But we didn't have anything to do with it. So therefore, devotees, we are humble. Right? We try to be humble. We try to understand that we're just part of something much far, far superior to us. Rather than materialistic people who think, yes, we did it. You know, I did it my way. And all the other silly mantras they have.
They can't even ask their own soul to stop going out of the body. Then how are they going to create another soul? They can't even stop. When Krishna calls, when material energy calls this soul to come out of the body and go into another body, our soul obeys that and goes, no? Without our permission at all. We are not doing anything in that. We say we don't want to go, still we have to go anyways.
Mm.
So they can't even make their own soul obey that. Mm. Obey their own rules. Mm. How are they going to create another mosquito?
Mm.
Another soul into another body. The own soul to own body, they can't stop their own death. They can't stop their own disease. How are they going to go?
This is the point.
Is Pradhan created only once?
Just Pradhan created only once. It means that Pradhan means all the energy before the creation takes place. All the jivas go back into Mahavishnu. And the Pradhan is manifest. Right? And the Lord sees the Pradhan. And he glances at it, and he glances the jivas back into the Pradhan. And then everything manifests again. And then when it all becomes unmanifest, right, all the jivas enter back into the Lord, it's just the material energy becomes inert once again. So it is an eternal energy. But sometimes it is manifest, sometimes it is unmanifest. Just like Prabhupada gave the example, the potter will make the clay and turn it into a pot, then in due course of time the pot goes back into the earth again. Like that. So in that way, like that. The Pradhan is just... Pradhan means when the energy is unmanifest.
In the first canto, we learned that Lord in the beginning of the creation created 16 elements of action, which is basically Pradhan, isn't it? In the beginning of the creation, I actually can't remember the chapter. The first
yeah, it means
first
that canto. It means in the Pradhan, there's no none of the elements are manifested.
Okay.
Right. It means the three modes of material nature are all unmanifested. They're all merged. Right? There's no different in Pradhan. There's no differentiation. If you look at Pradhan, you cannot see. Oh, there is earth. There is water. There is fire. There is air. It's all just
primordial soup.
Yeah, like that. It's unmanifest. Like that. It's as I said. There's no differentiation. Right? The three modes are not yet goodness, passion, ignorance. It's just all like that, like clay. Right? And then the potter makes it into something. But before that, it's just like that.
So when the Lord decides to wind up the creation, the Pradhan stays as it is, and he goes back.
Everything merges. Like when the destruction and the final destruction takes place, when Brahma leaves this world, and then the final destruction, then all the universes go back into the body of the Lord. Then at that time, all the energy just becomes merged again. Right? And then when the Lord glances, then it all becomes like that.
It was written that
material energy is the cause and effect? It's in verse 25. It
says
in the verse. 25. In the
verse. Translation. Verse 25, second line. But also in other places it was written, what confuses me, it's written that the time is the cause and effect.
Yeah, so the external energy, which is both the cause and the effect. So, yeah, the time is a different thing. Time is a different energy to the pradhan. Time is glance, is given by the Lord, it's a shakti. Pradhan's like a all the other elements mixed together. Like that. Everything will become clear in the next few weeks.
What I understood was, you know, when
I'm just going to read the last verse,
okay,
and then we'll finish because we need to finish also.
Okay.
The Supreme Living Being, in his feature as the transcendental Purusha incarnation, who is the Lord's plenary expansion, impregnates the material nature of three modes, and thus by the influence of eternal time, the living entities appear. So Prabhupada points out in the purport that by the Lord's glance, the jivas enter the material energy, the conditioned souls, they enter the material energy. But the one thing which makes it possible for the jivas to become liberated from the material energy is the Vedic knowledge. Because the Vedic knowledge teaches the jivas how to live their lives under the subordination of the Lord's rules. There are certain rules which must be followed in order to become liberated from the material energy. Just like if you buy a machine, you go and buy a car, or you go and buy a vacuum cleaner, or you go and buy a washing machine, then there is a instruction manual. And if you don't read it, then you will have problems like that. So with this material energy, the Lord puts all the jivas within the material energy. But in order for them to understand how to properly use the material energy, they have to follow the Vedic knowledge. And how to become liberated from the material energy, they have to follow the Vedic knowledge. And if they do not follow the Vedic knowledge, then they will misuse the energy. Right? And they'll become more and more bound and entrapped by the energy. So the Lord, he gives the jivas their fulfillment of their desires. He allows them to enter into the material energy. But then he also gives the process of how to extricate themselves from it and to live within it in a regulated way. That is the Vedic knowledge. So the Lord gives all these things. So on Monday night, we'll discuss verses 27 to 38. And then we'll begin to get into the intricacies or the details of the creation at that point in time. So the next, from now on, the next month or so, we'll study the creation very analytically. So if you have any questions, you should study it very carefully at this point in time, because it'll give you a chance to understand. This is a very important part of the Bhagavad Gita. And we'll go through it very carefully. So you should study yourself very carefully outside of class, so that when you come, if you have any questions, we can discuss it nicely. And we'll have our exam at the end of chapter 7, which is not too far away. And all of the open book exams, they need to be handed to me by the end of April. And all of the oral examinations need to be completed by the end of April. And the exam will probably be in the beginning of May or something like that. The closed book exam. Okay, Srila Prabhupada, thank you.